Chambao with Mari. Llévalo contigo. Take it with you. Take it with you. We heard a couple things from Little Anthony and the Imperials and Lenina. And that about does it for this week's edition of Radio Free Chico. Stay tuned for Peace and Social Justice. Your host, Chris Nelson's here with some very important things to convey to you. So stay tuned. I'll see you again next week. Bye-bye.
That's Brian Adams. A Canadian song is called Remembrance Day. And for many people around the world, it is Remembrance Day. Yesterday, it was also called Armistice Day. And it was a day that all wars were to end after the World War I tragedy that killed so many people. And yet wars have continued. And it's a kind of an interesting thing that we've just come to the end of 20 years of unabated wars, and I wanted to address today with my guest the issue of Afghanistan. In Afghanistan, 775,000 U.S. service members were deployed. Over 2,400 of them were killed. More than 20,000 came home injured. $1 trillion were spent, and around 66,000 Afghan soldiers were killed, and untold numbers of civilians lost their lives. there's also the remaining issues of all the people, 2.2 million refugees that have been fleeing Afghanistan over, I'm not sure on the timeline of that, through the occupation and now. And then they're also, now they're saying 23 million Afghans threatened with starvation. And so it is a rough thing to look back on. And I especially appreciate my guest today. His name is Dan Bershinsky. He graduated from the U.S. Military Academy at West Point in 2007 with a commission in the infantry. In the summer of 2009, then-Lieutenant Bershinsky and his men deployed to Afghanistan's, Arkhangelsk River Valley. On August 18th, Dan was severely wounded while leading his platoon on a dismounted patrol. He triggered an improvised explosive device, which instantly severed both of his legs above the knees, broke his jaw, and shattered his left arm. After being medically evacuated out of Afghanistan, he spent 4 months of inpatient surgeries and hospitalization at Walter Reed. He then spent the next 3 years undergoing daily physical therapy and prosthetic limb training. He has been doing a lot of work with this. He was the first above the knee and hip disarticulation amputee to walk on a daily basis, which is a real claim to fame. And he also was certified as a peer visitor, frequently visiting counseling other wounded service members and their families. He's been an advocate for improved bomb blast protective equipment for troops currently in combat. And he's an advocate for patient care and improved rehabilitation services practices at Walter Reed. He graduated from Stanford University's Graduate School of Business in 2015, now lives in Atlanta and has started his own small business. He has the Combat Infantryman's Badge, Ranger Tab, and Purple Heart Medal, among others. It is my honor to have you with us today, Dan Bershinsky, on the Peace and Justice Show here on KZFR Community Radio. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you're the most decorated veteran I've ever had on the show, so I'm a little nervous. because that is, you earned it the hard way, I'm afraid. And, you know, you started in your career when you were 17 after 9/11, and now you're 37. And you've had 20 years to have an overview, to have a perspective that is so much deeper and broader than any of us on the outside who think about the Afghanistan war, you know, infrequently and have not been there and, you know, have little experience. I was wondering about your overview now about the policies and all the lives lost and the treasure spent.
Yeah, with yesterday being Veterans Day here in the U.S., I spent the day kind of reflecting not just on my own service, but really the state of the nation in which I've grown up these last 20 years. Basically, my entire adult life, my country has been at war, in Afghanistan in particular, and that is where I deployed to, where I fought, and ultimately where I was wounded. My Army career came to an end. So what was most notable to me about this particular Veterans Day was the fact that the United States military is no longer fighting in Afghanistan for the first Veterans Day that I can really remember. And that's hugely monumental to me.
Mm. Yeah. So, you know, you have a lot of observations about being a veteran, and I'd like you to expound on that because you see it as an acknowledgement of our veteran service. And a lot of us peace advocates, you know, want to go back to the old Armistice Day. But why should we continue to call for an acknowledgement and honoring of veterans on November 11th?
Well, I share your sympathies, where I would much rather than celebrating Veterans Day, I wish we could celebrate Armistice Day, or, you know, the end of all war as we know it. That would be wonderful. I would very much like to live in a world without conflict. The unfortunate truth is that we don't. There can, at times, under certain circumstances, be a justified need for the military, for armed conflict. I think it is worth our while to reflect on the positive aspects of the military, and that's what Veterans Day, to me at least, that's the way I see it. So, you know, I served in Afghanistan. I'm incredibly proud of what I did, what I saw my soldiers, much more importantly, do, the selflessness, the enthusiasm, the effort, the humanity, the compassion that they put out. It's quite interesting that I saw all of those traits displayed in the middle of a terrible situation, which is war. What I find myself thinking about on Veterans Day is just how incredible the things that I witnessed, how incredible they were, and how much of a shame it is that it took war to bring those activities to light. And so what I mean is that I wish Americans could see this service that our veterans provide outside of the context of war. I wish we celebrated American service here at home in peacetime in the same way that we seem to be willing to celebrate the service of veterans, typically highlighted by combat experiences, if that makes sense.
Yeah, you wrote to me that you wish we thanked our teachers, doctors, public workers, garbage men, etc., like we thank our veterans, which I think is very generous of you because, yes, service workers in the United States do not get any recognition for their service. And in a hyper-militarized country, it sometimes seems very, you know, unequal in terms of who gets recognized for service. But, you know, in your case, I wanted to ask you to expound more about those years in Afghanistan. We put a lot of money into the country, but there was also friendships forged, NGOs started, a lot in the civilian sector that interfaced with the military. And I'd like to highlight a little bit through your experience what you're talking about in terms of what the troops did there that you saw as positive.
Yeah, well, I think this was all brought to stark relief this past August with the final withdrawal of American troops from Afghanistan for what seems to me, for the first time in the last 19 and a half years, it felt like all of America's attention was focused on this war. And what I mean is, right after 9/11, America paid attention. Mm-hmm. When we immediately invaded and occupied Afghanistan to seek retribution against Al-Qaeda for the international terrorist crime that they committed on 9/11, everyone paid attention. After about the first 6 months, once we had achieved our initial aims of destroying Al-Qaeda, destabilizing them, destroying their ability to hurt us again in a similar fashion, America stopped paying attention. The initial mission was over at that point. The Pentagon and the White House at the time decided that the next step in the effort was to rebuild Afghanistan, in my opinion, into a type of democratic government that it has never been and clearly never can be. Mm-hmm. And so America tuned out, and for 19 and a half years, the U.S. military was sent repeatedly, time and time again, back to Afghanistan to attempt a Sisyphean task and to change the country. So, despite all of that, our service members, who end up as veterans, went over there over and over again and put in their best effort. And we did build schools. We did build hospitals. We did provide a new form of security and stability that allowed an entire generation of Afghan women to experience basic fundamental human rights that we here in America take for granted and that we also appreciate. And those are remarkable achievements, and I'm incredibly proud of them. Mm-hmm. At the exact same time, I also acknowledge how impossible of a task, ultimately, it was. We achieved those improvements, and they were temporary. They were almost ephemeral, in a sense, as we all saw in August. As soon as we announced the full complete withdrawal of American troops. The Taliban swept back across the country, and within weeks, all of the progress we had spent 20 years worth of effort building was wiped away. And so it may sound odd, but I am both incredibly proud of all of the efforts that the U.S. military, the NGOs that we support, our government and diplomatic efforts over there. I'm incredibly proud of all of that. I also just think it was a huge waste. And I hope that America learns a lesson. And I think that lesson in its most simple form is, if we don't want our military to be sent overseas to fight unnecessary, unwinnable, and ultimately wasteful wars for decades at a time, we have to be more engaged. And as much as I appreciate being thanked for my service, it rings kind of hollow when I reflect back on these 20 years. And I have a random American, you know, citizen, neighbor, friend of mine thank me for my service. What I really want to say to him is, where have you been for 20 years? Mm-hmm. Why did you let us pursue an unwinnable task and spend trillions of dollars, thousands of lives, thousands of limbs? If you really want to take a veteran for his service, you need to guarantee that we are used only when necessary. And the last 20 years of effort in Afghanistan was anything but necessary.
Mm. Well, I'm hearing you. I'm very sorry. One of the things that went through my head as you were speaking just now is how often you were interviewed in August while the troops were being withdrawn during that very stressful time, and when there was all this controversy about whether Biden was right to withdraw the troops and the mistakes he or the administration or the military made in terms of how it was done. And so you had multiple interviews then, and then no interviews after that. So I'm afraid the American people are going to forget. And I would like to ask you about the end of the war and to make some comment about it, how it was carried out, and your thoughts about the fact about forgetting.
The end of the war was unfortunate and completely unavoidable at the same time. I am firm in my belief that the right thing to do was to end that war. It should have been done 19 and a half years ago, mm-hmm. after we achieved our initial stated aims of destroying Al-Qaeda and making sure they could not conduct another 9/11 style terrorist attack again. And no matter how the war ended, whether ugly or clean or messy, and I would challenge anyone who thinks there is a clean way to end a war, no matter how it ended, it was the right thing to end it. And I have nothing but respect and admiration for the current presidential administration that was the fourth administration to oversee this war, and the only administration that had the guts to end it, to acknowledge the futility and to end it and to bring the loss of life and expenditure of resources to an end. And so it was messy. I didn't enjoy watching it, but I wish it had happened 19 and a half years ago or 15 years ago or 10 years ago or 5 years ago, 2 years ago. Any of those times would have been great.
Yeah, for sure. And now, you know, on the issue of forgetting, I worry about the 10,000 recruiters that are currently stalking through U.S. high school hallways and trying to interest young people in signing up for the next war if there is going to be one, but they will continue to recruit. It's a poverty draft, some say, an economic draft. What are your thoughts about forgetting the lessons of Afghanistan? That's what I fear the most. And also the people left behind in Afghanistan, I don't want to see them forgotten either. And I just want to remind my listeners, this is Chris. I'm speaking with Dan Brzezinski. He is an Afghanistan war veteran who Won the Purple Heart, among many things. He is also disabled by his service there. Go ahead, Dan.
Sure. I share those same concerns. I want the American people to be engaged, and this is a big ask. I want the American people to be engaged, you know, at their local level, state level, at the national level, and even at the foreign policy level. Again, we have sent our military to fight in Afghanistan and Iraq and other places around the world consistently for the last 20 years. And at least Afghanistan, we have seen that 20 years of effort was a complete waste. There is no other way to describe it. And you can blame the Pentagon and our generals that have been in charge of this war and have been just yes men who said, more troops, more time, more effort. Roger that, sir. They deserve blame. Every single presidential administration that oversaw this war deserves blame. Every class of Congress that failed to adequately assess the pros and the cons of this war deserves blame. And ultimately, every American voter also deserves blame because we put all of those decision makers in office. Mm-hmm. And the lesson that needs to be learned is if you care about what our military gets used for, if you care about supporting the troops, then you need to speak up and you need to make sure that our troops are used as a last resort, that our troops are used wisely and judiciously. Mm-hmm. Now, that's a huge ask, and, you know, I'm not naive. I don't think we'll see any change. America has a very well-established military-industrial complex. We are, you know, shrinking, but we are still a world hegemony. We're the only country in the world that can drop our military in someone else's backyard and leave them there for 20 years at a time and face very little repercussion.
Right.
Until the voters speak up and say, this is not the country that I want. This is not the foreign policy that I want. This is not how I want my military, my sons and daughters, my neighbors to be used. Then we will continue to see a disconnected Congress and overeager White House continue to use our military as a first or maybe just a second resort, but certainly far from a last resort. So the lesson we need to learn here is that we have to be engaged and voters have a say, and you need to make your voice heard.
Well, thank you for that. And I also, I have like 3 minutes left with you, and I want to ask you first, or just tell our listeners first, that, you know, President Joe Biden had a son that died of brain cancer, and he was aboard a military aircraft in Iraq, and he was exposed to these, what they call air burn pits, and he died in 2015. And, you know, there's a lot that happens with veterans, and I wanted to turn to healthcare, that that the VA still isn't covering the contaminants that service members were exposed to overseas, and that was a case, of course, of my husband, I mentioned before, who died of Agent Orange. But I was wondering about your experiences with the VA hospital. You spent a lot of time there when you were recovering from your IED amputations, and I know you also have some concerns about potential privatization of the VA. Can you address that?
Sure. I'm happy to say that my personal care that I've received at the VA, I am more than 100% disabled, so I'm a fully medically retired VA patient, fully covered. I do all of my health care at the VA. Mm-hmm. My personal experience has been great. That said, and this may sound a little crazy, the care I receive is pretty straightforward. I got both my legs blown off in Afghanistan, so I walk with two above-the-knee prostheses. You know, once the active-duty medical system saved my life, put me back together, taught me how to walk, put me through rehab, and then retired me, the VA, I do my annual checkups with them. I go see a local prosthetist here in Atlanta, and the VA fully reimburses them, and I don't even so much as sign a piece of paper. It's wonderful as a patient. I have government-run healthcare, and I love it. I get all the help that I need. When it comes to the VA, however, it's a massive institution that handles a bunch of different cases in different ways. So I wasn't a part of the Vietnam generation that never registered with the VA, that then, you know, became ill in my 60s, wanted to get cared for by the VA, and had to go through the enrollment process with the VA. We have a massive backlog because we have so many veterans in this country who are eligible for the VA, and that's a wonderful thing. But the VA's capacity to process everyone is limited, and it's been an effort, a work in progress to improve it over the last 10 years that I've been paying attention. And from what I understand, having never gone through it myself, it has improved significantly, but there's still room for improvement. When it comes to privatizing the VA, it's something I'm also familiar with and I'm not at all in favor of. Like I said, the VA does a great job for me. It does a great job for a lot of friends. There are plenty of people who have private health care in this country, clearly, and are dissatisfied with their level of care. There is nothing inherently good or bad about receiving your care from the government or from the private industry. What matters is the outcomes and the cost. And from my perspective, as a user, my costs are zero. I never pay a thing for the VA. That's wonderful. My outcomes have been great. I do not want the government simply to be a checkbook that pays into private health care, and I have to go find my own doctor on my own. There's something really unique about being in a VA hospital surrounded by other veterans with doctors who are experienced and these specific kinds of illnesses and injuries and backgrounds that are related to military service. I like the hybrid approach. You know, there are some good things where some of our more rural veterans who may not have immediate access to a large VA facility, of course, they should be able to get care in their community if there is care. But again, the private healthcare industry is not the best at providing care to low-density areas of our country. So it's a complex topic. I can only speak anecdotally about my own experience, but I have no complaints, and I appreciate all of the health care that I've received. It's, you know, allowed me to live a happy, healthy, productive life that I think if I had been a civilian working on a construction site, had both my legs chopped off, I think I'd be in much worse condition, even if I had private health care, than I am now. Yeah. I know too many amputees on the civilian side that have to argue every single time they need a new prosthesis. All I have to do is email a doctor. It's easy.
Wow. Well, those are good points. And I want to thank you so much, Dan Burschinski, for being my guest today on the Peace and Justice Show. And I wonder if you have any last words for our listeners before we let you go back to your life there in Atlanta.
Yeah, I guess we should return back to the meaning of Veterans Day. And, you know, I really appreciate having had the opportunity and the privilege to have grown up in a country that has many flaws but also has many strengths. I appreciate the support and the help I have received from friends, family, neighbors, and my government in general. And I want to say thank you to everyone who helps veterans. And the message I want to leave you with is please continue to support your veteran community. The best way you can do that is making sure that our military is used as sparingly as possible. It's not just a good thing for you to do. I believe it is an obligation for every American.
Thank you, Dan Burschinski, for everything. I really appreciate you. Take care, please.
Thank you very much.
All right. Bye-bye. All right, so you're listening to the Peace and Justice program. I just wanted to do a couple of announcements before we move on to our next guest. And there are a couple of things. Well, tonight, of course, is a John Craigie concert, and go on the KZFR website to find out how to get tickets for that. We want to support the station as much as possible, and I'm sure you're all ready for a good time. Also, on Sunday, Robert Bowman, who is an incredible pianist, is doing a fundraiser for the North Valley Shelter Team, who does cleanups at Comanche Creek and has got a shower trailer now, and they are, you know, pretty much doing it on a shoestring. So on Sunday at 7:30 at St. John's Episcopal Church on Floral, there will be a wonderful concert that is a fundraiser for North Valley Shelter Team. And also, this is Transgender Awareness Week, and the Transgender Day of Remembrance is on the 20th. And if you want to participate locally with the Stonewall Alliance, there is a community altar on the 15th from 10 to 4:30 at Faith Lutheran Church, Room 5, and a candlelight vigil November 20th from 6 to 8 outside in the Faith Lutheran Courtyard. And the weather should be good, so I hope that our community will support the truth that trans is beautiful. So we're going to go on, but first I want to thank our underwriters, as always. I'd like to thank Chico Natural Foods Cooperative, offering a variety of organic and local produce, organic groceries, and supplements. The co-op has hot food, ready-to-eat sandwiches, and cold brew coffee. The co-op now accepts online orders for curbside pickup. Chico Natural Foods Co-op is open every day on the corner of 8th and Main Streets in downtown Chico. Also like to thank Quicksilver Courier Service. They were established in 2010. And Quicksilver Courier Service has the flexibility to provide a broad range of delivery services for private individuals, as well as for legal, medical, and business professionals. Visit ChicoCourier.com for quality 24/7 delivery service. It's noon straight up. This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. And the opinions voiced on this program do not necessarily reflect the views of or opinions of KZFR, its staff, volunteers, board of directors, or underwriters, just mine and my guests. And I'd like to thank a few more underwriters, and I'd like to thank Paradise Community Guilds, fostering community by nurturing creativity, practicing stewardship of nature, and promoting values of sustainability. Paradise Community Guilds invites all people of goodwill and community spirit to help carry out that intent. To get involved, visit paradiseguilds.org, also on Facebook, and at 762-1490. And lastly, I want to thank KIXE PBS, which is hosting their annual holiday auction on November 10th through the 13th at 7 p.m. You can also view the items and bid on them now online at KIXE.org, including the wine auction. From fishing trips to art glass, getaway weekends to tires, you'll find it all at the KIXE annual holiday auction at KIXE.org. So let me put on another song. This is from the CD Extremists for Peace. And here you go.
In the morning, grab some coffee on the go. In the car, sit back, turn on the radio. An attack outside of Baghdad, another chopper down. Fights will be at half-mast in the center of the town. The evening news comes on the TV. Two Marines are killed by Planet IED. They attacked the convoy, blew a hole in the Humvee. Two Marines are killed, two families left to grieve. Our men and women are dying overseas. In a war that was starting, that didn't have to be. The brightest and the bravest just coming of age. Where is the anger? Oh, where is the rage? Where is the anger? Oh, where is the rage? A gray box draped in red, white, and blue. On a tarmac lies a soldier we hardly knew. Brave and patriotic, just 19 years of age. Story in the paper, section B, second page. Joined the army to be all he could be. A college education, otherwise would never be. Never thought he'd be dying on some foreign shore. Another army chaplain is standing at the door. Our men and women are dying overseas in a war that was started that didn't have to be. The brightest and the bravest just coming of age. Where is the anger? Oh, where is the rage? Where is the anger? Oh, where is the rage? The honor guard stands proudly by the grave. Parents weeping softly bow their heads and pray. Taps echo in the distance is the only sound as the patriotic soldier is lowered into the ground. A young mother and child all alone. A daddy and a husband who's never coming home. A flag up on the mantle with the medals that he wore. A picture on the table, sad memories of war. Our men and women are dying overseas in a war that was started that didn't have to be. The brightest and the bravest just coming of age. Where is the anger?
All that loss, you know, that is... That's a good song, I think, and I appreciate the Veterans for Peace folks, Pat Scanlon and friends, for putting together this CD. And we're going to be talking more about Veterans for Peace now. We have on the line with us Adrienne Kinney. She served in the U.S. Army and Army Reserves from 1994 to 2004 as an Arabic linguist in military intelligence. Following September 11th, Adrienne was activated in the reserves and stationed stateside, where she served in direct support of operations in Afghanistan and Iraq. Currently, she works to improve veterans' health care through the VA. Since joining since being involved in that in 2007, she's helped from the Vermont chapter, served at Northeast Regional Coordinator, and was on the Winter Soldier organizing team. She is currently the president of the Veterans for Peace organization. So welcome, Adrienne. I am so sorry I was caught there. That is Iraq Veterans Against War, IVAW.
Yeah.
Hi, sorry. Hey, Adrienne, you know, this is the last day of the COP summit, and I know that Veterans for Peace has been doing a lot to try to make the American people and those at COP aware of the of how important it is for the military to be downsized in order to help climate, you know, to decrease our greenhouse gas emissions. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that. I know it has been a major focus in this leading up to the COP. And what are your thoughts about how this is, you know, has it had any effect? Or as this is the last day of the COP, what are you thinking?
So I have a few thoughts. Number one, we've had some amazing Veterans for Peace members on the ground in Glasgow. David Collins has been reaching out to all of the delegates to try to encourage them to address the issue of military emissions and their relationship to the climate crisis we're facing. We've had many members tuning in to the People's Summit and giving workshops. And the People's Summit is essentially the people gathering in the domain of the COP, since people are not really allowed in the official COP proceedings. So the two thoughts I have is that, number one, people are really waking up and joining the call for the military emissions to be included and addressed and for the military to be downsized in order to save the planet. Unfortunately, it looks like the COP26 has been officially a bit of a disaster, and in terms of there not being any hard-lined actions being called for by the big, you know, mainstream countries who are represented at the COP. So, you know, we're getting to the point of no return, and people have been cautioning us about this inevitability for decades, and the amount of urgency that people are feeling, particularly the youth of the world, it's incredibly tangible. Mm-hmm. And I am hoping that, you know, the people can continue the pressure beyond the cup or calls for, you know, critical actions to address the climate crisis.
You know, Amy Martin asked House Speaker Pelosi about the bloated U.S. military spending, and Pelosi gave her some sort of a vague reply about how the military is going to be needed in a climate destabilized world. And I was wondering, how would you respond to Speaker Pelosi if she said that in your presence and you had the floor?
I would say that that's probably one of the most disgusting things I've ever heard somebody say, that the U.S. is contributing to a global crisis. It sounds like she is encouraging that to happen so that we can continue to justify outrageous spending on our military, which by far and large does not go to support actual troops, but goes to the pockets of contractors.
Yeah. Yeah, and yesterday, Veterans for Peace, I missed this webinar, but it looked really good. The topic was Veterans Day enables nationalism, and then one of the speakers says, and moralizes violence. Can you talk about your take on Veterans Day?
You know, growing up, it seemed that Veterans Day was a typical just day to pause and reflect and to honor veterans. And that was true even when I had served in the military the first few years. But particularly in the years since 9/11, the nationalistic fervor that is wound up in regards to Veterans Day, you know, originally it was Armistice Day, and the original proclamation called and begged upon the people of the United States to pause and reflect and to be thankful for peace. And that has been erased by people who want to support endless war for their own profit and control. And it kind of disgusts me that veterans are used as a poster child to silence the American public and say that you are not allowed to have an opinion about war and militarism, but just to support the troops. And the amount of hero worship for veterans, it's, you know, it's hollow. If anything, our government should be trying to work towards diplomacy to save veterans from having to go to war and being created in the first place.
Yeah,
and
be disabled,
right?
Yeah. It's a terrible thing to think of someone living through their whole life with the kind of disabilities that so many people over the last 20 years have had. One of the stats I wanted to read our listeners is the $1 trillion spent in Afghanistan could have been put toward building sustainable green infrastructure in the U.S. $1 trillion could have provided a home to every homeless person in the U.S. And so the U.S. Geopolitical interests, military-industrial complex, R&D, spend $778 billion on the 2020 Pentagon budget while nickel-and-diming social programs. I mean, it isn't even close what we're doing for our civilian infrastructure compared to what we have done in these wars. And I want to hear a little more of your anger before we change topics.
Sure. Yeah, the bloated Pentagon budget is, you know, it's justified anger at the way that our resources are misdirected and misspent. And the United States is so far behind the rest of the world in so many health, in regards to so many health criteria, maternal death, premature births, literacy rates. Just, you know, we could be and we should be doing so much better for our citizens. And our citizens include veterans of every single war we've ever been involved in. So the more we can support services for the public good, the more we also support veterans, they shouldn't be seen as two separate things. Mm-hmm. But instead, our government chooses to line their own pockets and the pockets of their friends through contracts, private contracts that just create more and more and more chaos in the world.
Yeah, and I'm speaking with Adrienne Kinney. She's the president of Veterans for Peace and a veteran herself. And there was something I was going to ask my last guest, but I didn't ask him, about the fact that even though we've pulled out of these wars, that we still have wars spilling on in insidious ways that are harder to see and harder to resist, official and unofficial special forces operations, drone strikes and surveillance, and the training and maintenance of proxy forces. Now that what we call endless wars seem to be over, what can you say to us about this? Again, it comes back to military spending, but about how this goes on, this military mindset.
You know, it seems like it's a regression to the Reagan era hidden wars, that drone strikes are continuing. You know, instead of having boots on the ground, I feel like the U.S. government is moving towards wars that are rooted in use of artificial intelligence like drones. And it's only my guess that they hope that, you know, without having boots on the ground, people will be silent because they don't have their brothers and sisters and sons and daughters deployed overseas fighting a war. And I can just hope that people will continue to speak out, particularly about the use of drones. I mean, over the last 10 years, the drone strikes have killed so many innocent women and men and children. And you know, that kind of violence where it's, you can't even see the face of the person who has killed you, is, I can't even begin to imagine it, to be afraid every time a plane flies overhead whether or not it's going to drop a bomb on you. Right. Things are shifting, but they haven't shifted in the positive kind of way that I would hope to see our country take.
Right. And you were an Arabic linguist, and I think you spent, I listened to one interview that you did that you talked about that you were listening in on conversations, and sometimes it was American conversations, and you were somewhat shocked that, you know, that Americans were being targeted for, you know, for people listening in on conversations. And I was wondering, was your work used in targeting of people?
It is very difficult. I mean, military intelligence, it's so compartmentalized that everybody does their little piece, but particularly people on the lower level, you know, interceptors, translators, you know, they do the report and then they send it on up. And how it's used is largely decided outside of our purview. So, you know, all I could say is that when I was on active duty in 94 to 98, before 9/11, if we accidentally intercepted, even if it was a military intelligence, like a Syrian military radio report, and they mentioned an American by name to include travel details, we would delete it because it was, the military is not supposed to report on American citizens. And so after 9/11, I remember seeing these, we were intercepting satellite phone communications. And at first, a lot of the phones were not identified. And so they would just show up in the database by the phone number. And over time, I saw those phone numbers being changed to ABC News correspondent or UNICEF. And rather than being blocked by the system, which was totally possible, these were being intercepted and given priorities that were far above, you know, don't bother listening to them. So there was an expectation that we would listen to them and report on them. And when I raised that as a concern, because I had served on active duty before and I knew that wasn't part of the deal, I was largely dismissed and treated like I was somehow un-American.
Yeah, that's really interesting. You know, but you started your career in the military just out of high school. And as a woman, I was also wondering about your status and how you were treated as a woman, because there's been so much information about women's issues in the military, and especially you as a kid. How did it go for you in terms of being respected and treated as an equal?
You know, I've thought about that a lot, particularly as my niece is getting to be the age that I was when I joined the military. And at the time I served, things seemed normal. But as an adult with the experience, I look back and I cringe thinking about some of the things that I experienced, but also knowing that someone experienced much harder situations in the military. So it's, you know, the rough estimate is 1 in 3 women in the military is subjected to military sexual assault and violence. That there is a lot of misogyny and racism and homophobia and transphobia in the military, and that's all part of the military trying to train its soldiers to dehumanize the enemy. And it starts by dehumanizing one another. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that from my perspective is why the military, it's a part of the reason the military can be such a violent place where soldiers turn on one another and incredibly violent and sexist and racist ways.
Mm. Oops. Hi, you still there?
I am.
Good. So, Adrienne Kinney, you're the president of Veterans for Peace, and I know there's a big age divide there. There's my age group, my cohort, which are the Vietnam era, probably cisgendered, mostly white veterans, and then there's a younger generation from the last 20 years. And how is it going there at Veterans for Peace, and what are some of your challenges as a president?
You know, I think that like many organizations that are facing kind of a growing generational diversity, that we're all figuring out how we can best create space for new ideas and new energy while also honoring the wisdom of those who have been, you know, walking the line for decades in some cases. Mm-hmm. So that has been difficult at times, to be perfectly honest. Sometimes, you know, new people, new ideas, veterans have a lot of mistrust and people don't like change in general. So it's something we are continuing to work on. One of the things that we have developed is kind of a way of creating different spaces for people to come together and do work. So one of our initiatives is Gamers for Peace, and that's largely younger veterans. I mean, I've been out of the military for 18, 19 years. So I'm kind of in the middle area somehow, but there are younger veterans and students and Gamers for Peace who are doing online activism to counter the military's invasion of online gaming spaces, in which they're targeting kids as young as 13 years old with, you know, military propaganda, you know, without the oversight of any institution such as school or their parents. So, you know, we're trying to create spaces for groups to work on their projects, but then of course we're also a collective and collaborate on issues together. And one of the things we're also working on is how we can incorporate ideas of restorative and transformative justice, so that when people aren't being their best selves, we can figure out how to call them in and help them be better in terms of their interactions with others. while also, you know, having accountability so that people who have had harm directed at them from fellow members don't feel like their harm that they've experienced is, you know, doesn't matter, because it does all matter, and we're all trying to figure out how to call people in and educate people so that we can all grow and learn better as human beings how to work in collaboration, particularly in the peace and social justice movement.
Mm. Yeah, I was just thinking of my generation and how rigid you get with age and how hard-headed, and then you throw in PTSD or head injuries or whatever else, and it's like, oh my goodness, that is quite a group. But, you know, mention to us about all the chapters there are and some of the good work, because I want people, you know, I've had many people on from Veterans for Peace. It's one of the, you know, it's one of the groups that I love the most in this country. But I just want, you know, this Armistice Day to really honor the veterans who have turned to peace as their activism.
Yeah. So, and one of our big initiatives is Reclaim Armistice Day. And we had, I don't even know how many chapters. I know the chapter here in Syracuse for years has reached out to our mayor and asked him to sign a proclamation renaming Veterans Day Armistice Day. And there was a celebration and ceremony of that, him signing that proclamation this Armistice Day in Syracuse, New York.
Cool.
And they're just one of many chapters around the country who were doing the same thing of trying to bring the focus back to honoring peace and an end to war.
Yeah. So last words, Adrian Kinney, I wanted to just give you the floor to, you know, if you want support for Veterans for Peace or, you know, well, whatever you would like to say.
I just, you know, sometimes it can be very overwhelming, particularly as it seems like the difficulties and struggles we're facing are increasing instead of being resolved. And, you know, too, with the climate crisis, with the racial injustice, but at the same time, I see that people are waking up and people are getting involved. And COVID, I think, was a wake-up for a lot of people. You know, workers are finally realizing that their labor is more valuable than people are willing to pay them, and that they deserve a livable wage.
Mm-hmm.
And people are withholding their labor until people kind of, you know, get with the program. So, you know, people are waking up, and I guess patience is one of those things that we all have to work on, and I work on that myself. But, you know, patience with a sense of urgency and activism, I think there's a way of balancing those, but also taking care of ourselves, too. So I just appreciate everything everybody does, and I remind myself that there are a lot of people out there doing awesome work. And whether or not I know about it, it's happening. And this is such a great way. And I appreciate your program and the invitation to join, because this is one of the ways we get to remind ourselves of, you know, everything that everybody is doing to try to make the world a better place.
Right. Our interconnectedness is so important. Thank you so much for your work, and best wishes to all of you in Syracuse, New York. Peace.
All right. Peace.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
Okay, so I want to run you a quick thing on vaccination. She mentioned COVID, and it's so important that people get vaccinated. We are only at 47% in our county, and people are not masking, so they are at risk of a very serious illness. Here you go.
At KZFR, we take the health and safety of our community thoughtfully and seriously. To best protect our friends and family in the North State, we as an organization believe that following local guidelines and safety protocols as they relate to COVID-19 can bring us out of the pandemic. That's wearing a mask when necessary, social distancing, receiving a vaccination, and promoting fact-based science. Find where you can get a vaccination today by visiting vaccines.gov, an operation of the Center for Disease Control, or you can call the Butte County Public Health Department at 530-552-5555. 4000. KZFR has been doing our part by having our staff, board, and committee meetings on Zoom, educating our programmers on how to broadcast from home, altering pledge drives to reduce foot traffic in the studio, promoting sanitization of our studios and workspaces, and much more. KZFR urges you to do your part to help the station and our community return to a normal life.
And thank you to our general manager for making that. It was great. So this is Chris. The show is the Peace and Justice Program. I have one more guest, a very important book I'm very pleased to be able to bring you. It's called White Christian Privilege, The Illusion of Religious Equality in America. And I will be speaking with the author here in a minute. I'm going to put on a song so that we can transition to that. And stay tuned here. It's another song from Pat Scanlon and some kids.
Please don't take our hopes and dreams and blow them all away. We hope we will inherit this life and earth from you. Like all of you who came before, we're just passing through. We cannot drink the water, who knows what's in the air. Nuclear and toxic waste are buried here and there. Our coastline is polluted, there's garbage everywhere. We know that it's not all your fault, but most of you don't care. We're the future generations, born the other day. Please don't take our hopes and dreams and blow them all away. We hope we will inherit this life and earth from you. Like all of you who came before, we're just passing through. Some of you are wealthy, two cars and dressed real fine. Others walk on worn-out shoes to the unemployment line. Our cities are decaying, the streets are filled with crime. If we could work together, why, there still may be some time. We're the future generation, born the other day. Please don't take our hopes and dreams and blow them all away. We hope we will inherit this life and earth from you. Like all of you who came before, we're just passing through. Species are in danger, the condor and the whale, the rhino and the elephant, don't forget the noonday snail. These creatures all belong here as much as you and I. It is up to every one of us to see that they don't die. We're the future generation, born the other day. Please don't take our hopes and dreams and blow them all away. We hope we will inherit this life and earth from you. Like all of you who came before, we're just passing through.
All right, and so my last guest today, I am so pleased to be able to bring you, Kati Joshi. She is a scholar and thought leader on the intersecting issues of race, religion, and immigration in the United States. Her writings, speeches, and coursework focus on promoting cultural and religious pluralism in the United States. Dr. Joshi is also co-founder of the Institute for Teaching Diversity and Social Justice, which offers institutes, workshops, and resources. Through her workshops and consulting, Dr. Joshi engages educators, policymakers, and community leaders in an examination of the historical and systemic nature of bias, its consequences in everyday life, and the solutions that foster social justice and inclusiveness. In doing so, she provides clients with the tools to enhance both their own and the organization's ability to provide inclusive, meaningful services and experiences in an increasingly connected and diverse world. Her research and scholarly work taps the experience of South Asian Americans and other immigrant communities to illuminate race relations and inform interfaith work in the United States. She is an author, editor, and contributor to numerous groundbreaking books and journals in her field. She's a professor of the School of Education at Fairleigh Dickinson University and the author of the book that we want to discuss today, the newly released book, White Christian Privilege, The Illusion of Religious Equality in America. So welcome, Dr. Joshi, to the Peace and Justice Program. Hello.
Hi there. Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yes. Well, thank you for this wonderful book. I told you that this had a huge influence on me because it's things that I had not considered before. In the way that you present it, I do strongly recommend this book to our listeners, White Christian Privilege. And it is... It is New York University Press, published in 2020. And in the book, you talk about Christianity, particularly Protestantism, has been integral to U.S. national identity. Christian beliefs, norms, and practices, and indeed a Christian way of looking at the world, infuse our society, enjoying countless legal, structural, and cultural supports whose roots reach back to the arrival of Europeans and the founding of the country. Protestant perspectives have become the truths at the bedrock of American society. And for some reason, that never showed up for me before. But how did you come to writing this book? What brought you to this place of the research and the understanding that you had to put this together?
Well, Chris, actually, I want to first start with saying thanks for, you know, kind of saying straight up that, you know, you hadn't seen this information before, right? You hadn't seen, and how did you not see this?
Right.
And that's what happens with issues around privilege. We can't see it until they're often invisible until we make them visible. I came to this book is really both a professional and personal project. I, as a Indian American Hindu growing up in Atlanta, Georgia, didn't quite fit in, you know. And I wasn't black, I wasn't white, and then on top of that, when I said, or my family said we were Hindu, it was kind of like, what's that? And so I realized over the course of my lifetime that while sometimes I experienced discrimination and marginalization, there were other times that it was just that somebody else had the secret password. Somebody else knew the conversation that was happening, and I didn't because I didn't understand certain terms. And that's the privilege piece, you know, that's the privilege piece. And so I do share a number of personal stories and stories about my family in the book, weaving them together with actual history and law to show just how Christianity and whiteness are embedded in our legal and social structure.
Yeah, and those are important. You know, I would like to, with the limited time we have, I'd like to give you the platform to tell us some history about the colonial period and the immigration period in terms of making the case for this Christian privilege, normativity, and hegemony. I can never say that. So
yeah, we can leave that word out for right now. We can talk about that other stuff. It's fine.
Go for it.
So I think that the first thing is that, you know, when we are in elementary school, we are taught that, you know, the U.S. was founded on religious freedom. And that's not entirely the truth, right? Yes, the Puritans were coming to the United States seeking religious freedom, but it was just for themselves. They were not in it for everybody. They were in it for themselves. And so we get a partial truth from the very beginning, you know, first grade, second grade, that stays with us forever. That, combined with the fact that people see religious diversity in our country today, combined with the fact that people know that there is freedom of religion in the First Amendment, think, therefore, it must be so, right? Especially the presence of religious diversity translates as religious equality in this country, and that's just not true. And so from the very beginning, Christianity has enjoyed a privileged place. And a couple of specific historical moments I can bring up. One is in 1819, when Congress passed what is called the Civilization Act of 1819, which sent federal dollars to Presbyterian missionaries to convert indigenous communities, right? I mean, they were very direct about it. And even the title of the act, the Civilization Act, because
when it came to everything with Native and Indigenous communities, it was always the distinction between civilized and uncivilized, right? Those who are Christian are civilized. Those who are not are uncivilized and heathen. So there's a lot that can be said in terms of Native and Indigenous communities and around Christianity. And if we have more time, I'll get into it. You brought up stuff around immigration law, and there's a couple of things we can say there. So we can... I'll bring up, in the interest of time, two specific cases, the Immigration Act of 1917 and the Immigration Act of 1924. Now, we have to situate these in context. So 1917, you know, World War I was going on. In the United States, we saw a rise in nativism and xenophobia. You know, anti-immigrant rhetoric was quite strong. The Klan had been kind of, there was a revival of the Klan and various nativist organizations. And these organizations across the country were successful in lobbying Congress to pass what is called the Immigration Act of 1917, which created a barred zone, meaning immigrants coming from present-day Iran through South Asia into Southeast Asia, people from this part of the planet, Chris, were no longer allowed to immigrate to the United States. So that's a pretty big deal, all right? And we have to think about what are the religious backgrounds of these folks, Hindus, Muslims, Sikhs, Jains, Zoroastrians, and others. Okay, the law says not one thing about religion, I want to be clear, but we do have to see in the end who was excluded. Now, to the Immigration Act of 1917, add the Immigration Act of 1924, which severely limited the number of immigrants coming from Southern and Eastern Europe. So I'm talking about the countries of Poland and Italy and the former Czechoslovakia and our present-day Baltic states of Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia. It included Greece, Russia, right? We severely limited immigration from these countries. Now, when you look at 1917... and you look at 1924, the common denominator is that the majority of people coming from these countries were not Protestant. In the case of Southern and Eastern Europe, the majority of the people coming from the countries where we limited immigration were Catholic, Jewish, and Eastern Russian Orthodox. Right? Again, the law says not one thing about religion. I want to be clear, and your listeners can go look it up. But when we see what happened, it's really clear that the United States Congress, through immigration policy, was socially engineering our demographics to skew white and Protestant.
Yeah, I think there is somewhere in there where you say, how did we become a nation of 76.5% white and 70.6% Christian. It's obviously been manufactured that way. But also in terms of the American national identity, I think that was pretty mind-blowing for me to really realize just what a lock it has. Can you describe that?
Well, I think that from the beginning, and I'm not sure exactly what you might be referring to, so if there's something specific you have in mind, that'll help me.
Well, the whole first chapter is about the normative power of Christianity and the universality of it in terms of the country, in terms of the this whole idea of Judeo-Christian and
right.
Yeah, so that whole chapter to me is about this national identity that we have.
Okay, sure. Well, and again, this national identity comes from not only immigration laws, but like, for example, Supreme Court decisions, right? And so one of the things about recognizing Christian privilege and Christian normativity and how they have helped to construct what is considered an American identity is that these are the things that are just considered normal, right? And so we can even take it down, if you will, to a kind of a micro level and think about, well, what's the normal way of praying? Well, you sit and you put your hands together. You know, it's not what I do at a Hindu temple, which is sit on the ground and pray, or what my parents often do, which is prostrate themselves in front of the deity. you know? Mm-hmm. And so it's about what gets considered normal. What's the normal image of God? And then everything else is othered. Instead of us being able to see difference as good, we have come to see difference as not good. And that to be American is, you know, how close can you get to being white and Christian? And the race piece is incredibly important there, because we know that Christian communities of color, Asian Americans, African Americans, they don't have the same level of privilege because of race, right? We wouldn't have black churches being set ablaze if by white Christians if race wasn't an issue. So sometimes we're talking about Christian normativity and Christian privilege, and sometimes we're talking about white Christian privilege.
So that I would like to you to describe for the listeners the racialization of religion, because this whole idea of the heathen, you know, the way this book weaves everything together really makes sense. But when I look at my notes, it's like, oh my goodness, she's going to have to describe this because I just took too many notes.
Sure. Well, the racialization of religion, and what I mean by that is that we have various racial groups in our country that then get equated with a certain religion. And context and time is important, right? So somebody in the 1960s who was from, say, any of the countries of South Asia, the presumption would be that they were probably Hindu. You know, this certainly happened 120 years ago when even if they were Sikh, they were considered Hindu. After 9/11, we see the racialization of religion enact in a different way, where everyone who is considered brown, phenotypically, you know, like characteristic of people who are darker skinned from Arab nations or from South Asia, it doesn't matter what our religions, we are equated to be Muslim. Mm. Right? And so that these religions are seen as interchangeable. You know, the religions are seen as one and the same, and that there's no distinction. And we see this often with Hinduism, Sikhism, and Islam. These are three entirely distinct world faiths, you know.
Right.
But so that's some of the stuff I'm talking about with the racialization of religion. One of the other things is that people of religious minority faiths these religions are often only seen as monoliths, you know. So Muslims do this, Hindus do this, Jews do this, you know, whereas the multiplicity of Christianity can be seen. And let me give you a specific example. I am Hindu, and I eat chicken and seafood. And I was eating with some colleagues a few years back, and somebody said, oh, Kathy, you know, you're Hindu, right? I thought you would be vegetarian. And as you know, this idea of, well, if you're Hindu, then you're a vegetarian. And I was feeling particularly cheeky that day. And because it wasn't a colleague and not a student, I would not have replied like this to a student. I said, well, Rick, you're Christian, right? So are you in church every Sunday? Right? No, of course not necessarily. And just because you're not doesn't mean you can't identify as Christian. But there's this sense, especially with religious faiths, minority religious faiths, I should say, that they're seen in monoliths.
Right.
So you must, you know, if you're Muslim, then you absolutely pray five times a day. No, there's some people who don't, and they still consider themselves Muslim.
Right, right. Yeah, I want to get more into some of the social justice issues that this brings up in terms of understanding one another better. But, you know, you brought up for me in this whole idea about the political risks we take by having a country that is so identified with whiteness and Christianity. There's a quote in, there's just a stat in here that 80% of white evangelicals believe discrimination against Christians is as big a problem as discrimination against other groups. And yet, Christianity has benefited from all of these state sanctions for the last 400 plus years. And mm-hmm. Can you talk about the influence of this in terms of the political rhetoric and hate crimes and the things that we're seeing now, why this is so important?
Yeah, well, so, you know,
when you've been used to getting your way for 400 years, trying to provide other folks equal opportunity can seem like now you're not getting everything that you used to get. So I think that's part of it. I think that, listen, let me be clear. When it comes to Christians, other folks as well, but when it comes to Christians, there's no question that in certain segments of our society, there's a bias against religiosity and there's a bias against Christians in terms of, you know, how going to church and the way they practice their faith. But that's why we have to consider the individual level of oppression and the institutional level of oppression. And when you look at institutions, we see all the ways that Christians have been advantaged for, as you say, for 400 years. Part of the reason they feel like they're being discriminated against is they, like you, Chris, and like most people until they read the book, don't understand the Christian privilege that's there. Right. And that's one of the things that we've got to start doing a better job of in education, is helping dominant group members, whether they're heterosexual, white, men, cisgender, you know, see the advantages you have in society, because society's been constructed for you. I consider myself an optimist, and you know, there's that optimistic side of me that does feel that some Christians, when exposed, you know, devout, in some cases evangelical, when exposed to this, might be open to being like, actually, you know what, we're not really as persecuted as my community is telling me. But that's the optimist in me, you know. But this does go back to how we're taught. And if we've never been taught that Christians have advantage throughout United States history, and then you're told that when you're 35, 45, 55, you're going, nope. Because if that had happened, I would have been taught it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, so I'm speaking with, this is the Peace and Justice Program. My name is Chris, and I'm speaking with Kati Joshi. She is the author of A White Christian Privilege, The Illusion of Religious Equality in America. And this is a powerful book, and I strongly recommend it for, well, even high school level students. I mean, it's good to get this really under your belt, because I think it really helps one's mindset in terms of how one looks at oneself if you are white, if you have come from the Christian tradition, and to just see it in a bigger platform. And one of the important parts of your book, Dr. Joshi, is about everyday Christian privilege. Before we get to the social justice part, I want you to just let us know about some of these blind spots, you know, as a Christian, you know, what am I looking at in terms of the difference between my religious perspective or my sense of myself in the world versus someone else's who is not defined that way?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's several, as I mentioned in the book, but, you know, some of the ones I can highlight is, you know, what land, you know, a cemetery would not be bulldozed to put a road in, but land considered sacred by Native Americans for hundreds of years is not considered sacred, and we build a road, you know, but we wouldn't do that to a cemetery where, you know, it's been designated as sacred land, because that's understood as sacred in the Protestant or overall Christian ethos. You know, there's also the idea of what is, you know, we say we have religious freedom in this country, and yet synagogues, Hindu temples, mosques are not able to be erected by a particular community, even in you know, the part of the town that's been zoned for religious houses of worship, right? So Christian privilege is I can put up a church wherever I want without opposition, for the most part, right? Or I can, my loyalty, if someone is running for elected office, my loyalty to this country is not questioned, as happens to people of color and or religious minorities. In fact, I talk about how Nikki Haley, when she was running for governor of South Carolina, her campaign would receive emails asking what was her religion, because people were like, because if she's Christian, then I can vote for her. Otherwise, I can't, because she can't represent me. So they finally added Chris to her website. Nikki is a Christian, you know. And so, I mean, these are the advantages that folks who are Christian and white don't come across. We know all the ways that President Obama was questioned. He said he was Christian, but that wasn't good enough, you know. And so there's just these everyday pieces, you know.
Right.
As a Christian, your religious holidays are understood. You don't have to explain them. I mean, I just celebrated Diwali last week, where I take 3 days off from work. My students know I'm not going to be around and all this. But when you're taking 3 days off to celebrate and the rest of the world is still spinning, you're like playing catch up.
That's right.
You know,
I don't want to run out of time for social justice, because this is what you ask of us. At the end of this book, there is a strong section on what is being asked of us to interrupt and eliminate this oppressiveness, and also to have some critical consciousness about it. And we only have like 2 or 3 minutes. So can you talk to us in a nutshell about social justice?
Yeah. We're going to have to, one of the things about religious diversity and striving for equality and justice is that so much, for example, of interfaith work has focused on how we are the same. And that's fine, but we cannot stop there. And thus far, so many interfaith efforts do stop there. We are going to have to talk about how we are different. And that's something I talk about in the need to change foundational assumptions, right? We've got to be able to talk about that. The way I pray looks very different than the way my friends who are Jewish pray, or the way that my friends who are Christian pray. And so that then also involves getting comfortable with being a little uncomfortable, because we don't always want to go to the difference because we're uncomfortable. But if we only do things that are comfortable, we're not going to get where we need to get as a society. So that's kind of a big picture idea. One of the other things I talk about is changing the questions. So that's more everyday stuff people can do. I've been asked countless times, oh, Kathy, well, what's your Bible? Well, I don't have a Bible. If we're talking and using the word Bible, we're talking about Christians. But if you're asking me, oh, what are your sacred scriptures? Yes, I can talk about that. Right. So I give some examples of just some specific changing the language can change the tone, and that can really be a conversation opener instead of a conversation stopper.
Yes. And so we are just about out of time, but I wanted to give you the last word to promote this book, because I've already promoted it. I highly suggest it. Can you promote your own book? Why should people buy this? Because I think it's so important, too.
Well, yes. You know, what I do in the book is, first of all, I try to bring sometimes topics that are not so accessible to, have written about it in an accessible manner as much as possible. I provide stories that make things come to life, that stays with people. And when it comes to privilege, it's really about making that which has been invisible visible.
Yes.
So that's what I'm trying to do, because I think then you can see perhaps in your own society, in your own neighborhood, in your own town, where you can make some change, because it's got to be grassroots. It's got to be really hyper local to make these changes. You know, the book is available in Audible for those who are book listeners, you know. It's in, you can get it as an Audible book, and it's also available in electronic format. And Chris, if anybody who purchases it through NYU Press can get 30% off by using the promo code Joshi30.
Thank you so much for being my guest today, and thank you for this important book, Dr. Joshi.
Thank you, and thanks for your interest in the subject matter.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right. Stay tuned for Playing Dead. They'll be up in a second. I want to thank our underwriters. As always, I would like to thank Chico Performances presenting A Very Chico Nutcracker on Friday and Saturday and Sunday, December 3rd, 4th, and 5th at Laxon Auditorium. Backed by popular demand, Chico Community Ballet's newly envisioned A Very Chico Nutcracker returns to the stage, infusing the rich history of Chico into the traditional Nutcracker Ballet. Tickets at the University box office at 898-6333 or at chicoperformances.com. And by Square Deal Mattress Factory, building the best night's sleep since 1920. Square Deal is celebrating over 100 years of making mattresses, bedding, furniture, and now face masks with the fabric of your choice right here in Chico. Square Deal is located at 1354 Humboldt Avenue. For details, see squaredealmattress.com. Stay tuned for the community calendar followed by Playing Dead. Please have peace, all of you. Love you. And here you go. Enjoy your afternoon.
Hey, listeners, it's time for the KZFR 90.1 FM Community Calendar with me, Megan Hammer. The Durham High cheerleaders are raising funds to support new bleachers in the football stadium and also to provide funds to replenish what the program needs. Their inaugural fundraiser for this year is a bicycle marathon called Mini Fondo, and they're excited to announce that they will be starting the tradition by offering an in-person and virtual event with COVID protocols in place on November 13th. All pre-registered bike participants will receive a shirt with sponsor names. For more information, contact Stacy Ann Button at 530-570-3226 or register at www.runsignup.com/race/CA/Durham/Durham Mini Fondo. If you have an event you'd like on the community calendar, let me know by sending us an email at cc@kzfr.org. This is the KZFR 90.1 FM Community Calendar.
All righty. It's that time again. Time for Playing Dead, Music of the Grateful Dead, every Friday afternoon from 1 to 3. My name's Ray. I'll be your host today. Kind of a fun show, a little something different for you. Let's thank some of our underwriters. And thank you, Chris, for another wonderful piece.